there are a lot of products out on the market today that are designed to imitate the real thing. There's plastic decking that looks like real wood. There's vinyl flooring that appears to be ceramic tile. You can even purchase fake fur or jewelry, phony noses, hair pieces, or other body parts. The purpose behind all these items is fairly obvious. But what about this? What about a can of spray-on mud? Spray-on mud, it's really designed to be used on the outside of your SUV. That way, right? Okay, good. It looks like you're actually using this large, muscular vehicle for more than just taking kids to soccer practice. You know, you're doing something with this thing. So you spray it on, and your friends think, wow, you must have just gotten back from a wilderness adventure, right? Surprisingly, maybe it's not surprising, I don't know, but sales for this product are actually going really well. Especially in America. Yeah, okay. That makes sense, right? If they want an authentic look, says inventor Colin Dowes, there's not a lot else they can do. There's not a lot of mud in Chelsea. That's where it was. Actually, in London is where it was invented, near there. But figures, doesn't it? But apparently $15 a can seems a reasonable price to replicate the appearance of authenticity. And you know, there's a lot of expressions of imitation in Christianity also that we try to pass off as being the real thing. Aren't there? I mean, good wishes can be mistaken for prayer. Success can be misconstrued as spiritual achievement. Inspirational stories can cover for what we would think as being preaching, right? There can be excellent music, and that can sort of substitute for authentic worship of the heart. And cliches can be handed out as biblical wisdom. Even an attractive personality can be mistaken for a spirit-filled life. But genuine Christianity is much more than just a look. And the hallmark of a genuine Christianity is Christian love. And that's what we've been looking at over the past couple. Well, we started last week and we'll continue through this week. And looking at seven essentials of genuine love so that we can enjoy a life of love in Christ with one another and before the unbelieving world. Seven essentials of genuine love. And if you recall from last week, we began with the observation that genuine love is affectionate. It's something that is actually coming out of the heart of someone who really has a desire to love that person. We also saw that the genuine love is accurate. In other words, it's in truth. It's not something that's just sort of thrown out there with these warm fuzzies that has no bearing in reality or no bearing in doctrinal truth. And we also saw that genuine love is ascending in prayer. If someone loves another, they're going to be praying for them and praying for them with all vigor, desiring to see God's blessing in their life. And the example that we saw for all of these character traits was found from the Apostle John, as he wrote the epistle 3 John. And if you would turn, by the way, to 3 John now as we continue our series. But we saw in this man these things demonstrated. His affection came out in verses 1 and 2 when he says, "The elder to the beloved Gaius, whom I love in truth." And then on verses 2 and 3, we noted that the word for love appears 4 times in the first 11 words of the epistle. Secondly, we saw it was accurate love in that he said, "I love in truth." Truth and love go hand in hand with one another. They're not to be separated. They without one another, they end up nullifying each other, and they don't really exist. And lastly, we saw the ascending character of genuine love in verses 2 and 4 when it just describes his prayer there. He said, "Beloved, I pray that in all respects you may prosper and be in good health, just as your soul prospers. For I was very glad when brethren came and bore witness to your truth. That is how you are walking in truth. I have no greater joy than this, than to hear of my children walking in the truth." So we saw that his ascending prayer there was really fueled by joy. joy that he had in seeing his spiritual children walk in truth. Well, we want to move forward and see the fourth essential of genuine love. And we find that in verses 5 through the beginning part of verse 6. And it is that genuine love is affirming. Genuine love is affirming. Follow along as I read verses 5 and the beginning portion of 6. He says, "Beloved, you are acting faithfully in whatever you accomplish for the brethren, and especially when they are strangers, and they bear witness to your love before the church." In these words here, the apostle is commending Gaius. We see that as he exhibits love toward him, he is actually affirming him verbally. When he says, "Beloved, you're acting faithfully," he's giving him a warm commendation. And that commendation was really prompted by reports that he received back from other brethren who had come from that church in that place. And they said, "This guy Gaius, he's amazing. We come through there, we're itinerant preachers, we're sharing the gospel, and we cannot proceed without this man's help and his care." And as we talked about last week, you'll recall that there was a reason for that. The inns of that time period were corrupt, brothels more than anything else. They weren't the kind of hotels that we see in this day and age. There certainly wasn't a Motel 6 nearby they could stop in at for a good clean bed and a good night's rest. There was no one, you know, leaving the light on for them at all. It was, you know, get through on your own or have to stay in these really rank places. He says here that you're acting faithfully, and it's noteworthy that his work here is flowing from faith. It's not merely something that he's sort of doing because he's supposed to or ought to. It's because he trusts God. He has faith in the truth of the gospel. And so that's the outworking of that. And so Gaius is encouraged with this commendation. The Apostle John is known as the Apostle of Love. Each one of his epistles, it's a main theme, love, agape. That term is used over and over and over again. And what we see here is his use of words actually communicating that love. Words are very important to God. The way we use words, they matter to him. Jesus said in Matthew 12:36 that people will give an account of every careless word uttered before the Lord on Judgment Day. Wow. Every careless word. The average person actually speaks about 25,000 words or so a day. It's a lot of words. It's a lot of words. Now, let me ask you this. Of all those words, how many of yours are edifying, encouraging? Or do they end up falling into a different category? Are they careless? We're told that the power of life and death is in the tongue in the book of James. And God's given words value. God tells us that. And we need to ask this the question here. How does the Bible actually describe the very best use of words? What makes a great use of words versus a sort of not so great use of words, or even a destructive use of words? And really, if we were to look at sort of the breadth of Scripture, and we don't have much time to develop this morning, but if we were to take a snapshot of all the pages of Scripture, we would see that there really are four elements to the best words in terms of God's perspective on words. And that would be, first, that words should be honest. Secondly, words should be few. Thirdly, words should be apt. And fourthly, words should be encouraging. Those four things. Words are to be honest. We see in Proverbs 16:13 that righteous lips are the delight of kings, and he who speaks right is loved. In other words, the king, the guy in charge, appreciates honest advisors. He doesn't want people around him that's going to deceive him or mislead him or just flatter him. So mutual trust is really the foundation to any real solid relationship. Proverbs 24:24 through 26 says this: "He who says to the wicked, 'You are righteous,' people will curse him. Nations will abhor him. But to those who rebuke the wicked will be delight, and a good blessing will come upon them. He kisses the lips who gives a right answer." And the word "right" there really means just straightforward. Someone who's straightforward and honest. And don't you appreciate that too when you find someone who's that way? Let's face it, you know when you're being sort of flattered or told something that's not true or sort of schmoozed. And no one likes that. And the Bible condemns flattery as being something that's just evil and perverted. But honest words are something that God holds very highly in regard. Secondly, they will be few. That 25,000 words you're speaking every day, guess what? If you could cut the number a little bit, that'd be a good thing probably. Wouldn't be bad to maybe kind of bring the ratio down a bit of words per minute. This is kind of ironic, but in Proverbs 17:28 it says this: even a fool, when he keeps silent, is considered wise. When he closes his lips, he is considered prudent. In other words, it's one thing to be a fool. It's another thing to just broadcast that fact to the world. You don't have to do that. You can be restraining in what you say. Asking irrelevant questions, bringing up irrelevant data, only succeeds in demonstrating one thing: ignorance. You don't need to volunteer that. Proverbs 10:14 says this: wise men store up knowledge, but with the mouth of the foolish, ruin is at hand. Proverbs 13:3, the one who guards his mouth preserves his life. The one who opens wide his lips comes to ruin. So here, you know, often what we say really gets us in more trouble than just what we do. And to think of people who they buy things maybe at too high a price because they speak too soon, there can be consequences like that. They can be credibility lost because of a betrayed confidence. And these are things that we need to keep very much in mind when we think about words. There's Proverbs 11:12-13 says, he who despises his neighbor lacks sense, but a man of understanding keeps silent. He who goes around as a talebearer reveals secrets, but he who is trustworthy conceals a matter. You know, there's just a pastime sometimes of complaining and talking behind people's backs. And apparently, if we've seen these Proverbs, that practice is very ancient. So all those things you see in the newsstands on the way out of the supermarket, they're really nothing new in some ways. There's always been gossip. There's always been sort of the titillating of the ear with the latest juicy tidbit of information, especially what you're not supposed to know. Hey, guess what? And I know you find yourself in the checkout stand sitting there going, you know, and let's face it, how many of you, you know, you do look over at the front page, all right? Go ahead, you can raise your hand, don't lie to me. Wow, I can't believe that. All right, it happens, right? Because you're sitting there and you're tired, right? You're ready to go. And honestly, it's just right there at that level. There it is. The latest gossip, right? And by God's grace, we just need to look. I don't care what Jen's doing. All right? I don't care. It doesn't matter. It's irrelevant. Right? Yeah. Okay. Proverbs 10:19. When there are many words, transgression is unavoidable, but he who restrains his lips is wise. So this verse just warns against talking too much. We don't need to do it. How many times have you said something and you just went, oh? Usually it's right at the moment the words are flying out. You're like, no, come back. Ah, and then it's too late. They're done. They've done their work. Well, thirdly, the best use of words is going to be calm. Proverbs 17:27 says this: he who restrains his words has knowledge, and he who has a cool spirit is a man of understanding. And really, there's three reasons why calmness is desirable here. One, calmness allows for a fair hearing. When you're interacting with someone and you're agitated, you're not going to hear what they're going to say probably. Proverbs 18:13 says, he who gives an answer before he hears, it is folly and shame to him. And that's what we're apt to do when we're not calm, right? We're thinking of what we're going to say next, yeah? You're going to say this, well, I'm going to say this. And we're like five moves down the road. We have no idea what the person was sharing because we're just already there, ready to fight. Secondly, a calmness is desirable because it allows tempers to cool a bit. Proverbs 15:1 says, a gentle answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. And lastly, calmness is desirable because its influence is very powerful, very potent. Proverbs 25:15 says this: by forbearance, a ruler may be persuaded, and a soft tongue breaks the bone. That's an amazing picture to think about. A soft tongue breaks the bone. I always kind of think of a guy, you know, he takes his arm, he just goes, puts his tongue on there and breaks the bone. Why? Because it's not agitating the situation further. There's a way in which when there's a softness of tone, much more can be accomplished. Lastly, and very quickly, the best use of words will be apt. I'm sorry, it's second to the last, but anyway, it'll be apt. In other words, Proverbs 15:23, a man has joy in an apt answer, and how delightful is a timely word. What's stressed here is the right words at the right time. Now, you and I, typically, what do? We'll have the right words at the wrong time. Or we'll have the wrong words at the right time. But how often do we have the right words at the right time? That's what we need. That's wisdom. I mean, the wrong words at the right time, that can just be a disaster, right? How many times have you found yourself just searching for the right words and you're going, oh, I don't know what to say? Well, we can grow in wisdom in that. But not only are the best words honest, few, calm, and appropriate, they're also encouraging. Go ahead and turn over to Ephesians 4, verse 29. Ephesians 4, verse 29. We see the Apostle Paul there encouraging the Ephesian church, and he says this, "Let no unwholesome word proceed from your mouth, but only such a word as is good for edification according to the need of the moment, that it may give grace to those who hear." Really, our times together as the people of God ought to be times of encouragement. And it's even a command here. You'll notice he says, let no, and then he has a description. And then later in the verse, but only. And then he goes on and describes things. There's forbidden speech and there's commanded speech here in this passage. What kind of speech is forbidden? It's really speech that is corrupting. It literally means speech that is rotten. If you've ever gone to the supermarket, you know, and you get that apple and it looks real great on the outside, you cut it in half, brown as brown can be. Ugh. See, at least when the banana's brown, you can make banana bread, right? What are you going to do with a brown apple? Nothing. You're going to throw that thing away. And that's the kind of speech you have here. It's rotten. It doesn't do anything good. It's unwholesome talk. It's abusive language. It's everything from lying to vulgarity would be covered here. Speech that's bitter. Speech that's angry. Speech that's full of malice or full of slander. But on the opposite side of the spectrum here, we see there's also edifying speech. Speech that is good for building up. As much as corrupt words can enter a heart and cause rottenness, edifying words can actually take someone's soul and build them up. That's powerful. That's exciting. What kind of words are these? These are words that are rooted in Scripture. They're God-centered words. When you think about it, all of us, as members of the local church, we have a job description. And it's found right here in Ephesians 4:29. This is what you and I are to be doing. Now, sometimes we feel maybe that edifying words, that we kind of confuse them with flattery. Does that mean I'm supposed to just say nice things about people all the time? You know, just, hey, oh, good to see you. Hey, yeah. Right? That kind of thing. No, it's not this plastic, artificial thing at all. And certainly we're not called to lie. If you see someone and they ask you something about themselves and, you know, you're put in an awkward situation, you are not, you know, well, I got to be edifying, so I'm just going to make something up. That's not it at all. Instead, what it really is we need to be people who can actually see in a clearer way how God is at work in one another. For real. We need to be able to see the grace of God at work in each other's lives. Because guess what? Everyone who's come to Christ, what are we guaranteed of? God is at work. He who began a good work will be faithful to complete it, right? We've even been looking at the perseverance of the saints. The very thing that we looked at it for the theme this morning. God is the one who perseveres. God is the one who is committed to this thing called sanctification. And so we have within one another his workings. The question is, can we see it or not? When Janet and I were looking for a building to get married in, we ran across one that was over in Glendale. It looked really nice. We thought, this might be the building. This could be the one. And so we knew we wanted Pastor Rich to do the wedding, right? We were sure of that. We knew everything else, but our church, of course, as now, just doesn't own a building, or didn't own a building then either. So we wanted to find a place. So we came across this place in Glendale. It was really pretty, really nice. We walked in, and we're thinking, this is beautiful. This could work out. And so, but I wanted to actually see from where I'd be standing, if I'm looking down the aisle, I wanted to see if I could see Janet coming in. I didn't want my sight lines messed up. That was important to me. So we're walking up there, and we get up to the very front. It would have been right about here, actually, except there was a railing. And there's yellow rope right across the entryway there to get up onto the platform. And Janet's like, are you sure you want to go up there? And I'm like, well, yeah, I want to go up there. I got to see if I can see you. I'm going up there. And she goes, but what if there's a rope there. I'm like, oh, big deal. It's a little woven rope. What's a rope going to do? Come on, right? So I just step over the rope, walk up there. Next thing you know it, woo, 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 woo. Alarms, lights. And I'm like, ah. So I run. I run to get back because I'm very embarrassed. And as I'm trying to clear the rope, I clip it. Yeah, I busted the rope too. So then I'm trying to fix the rope, right? I've got this, I'm down here, I'm trying to put this rope back on. And of course, someone on staff from the church came in, and I'm like, hi, we were trying to explain that, right? Well, anyway, that was my little encounter with a motion detector. Yeah, they had these motion detectors up there. Who would have known, right? I mean, I'm thinking, just a little rope, what's the big deal? Well, so that was our little motion detector experience. Really, what you and I need to do is we need to develop another kind of motion detector. When we deal with one another, we need to learn how to detect the movement of God's grace in each other's lives. That's what we need to do. And it's vital, because edifying words, as C.J. Mahaney states, point people to the activity of God in their lives. That's what they do. And so, really, we're looking for evidences of grace in the lives of one another. So my question to you would be this. Are you sensitive to the workings of grace in other people's lives? Have you developed that? Or are you more prone to find faults in other people? Nah, they're not doing this right. They're not doing that right. You see, when we don't have the ability to share edifying words with one another, it really reveals something about ourselves. Because, and maybe we're asking that question, why am I not a person of more wholesome speech already? Why am I not able to do that very much? Where does not seeing the grace of God in other people at work, where does that come from? Well, really, that comes from that preoccupation with the things that are wrong with other people, right? Then the question has to be, well, where does that come from? So I'm always seeing what's wrong in other people. I'm not able to really, really emphasize God's workings. Really, that, if we're honest, stems from pride and a spirit of self-righteousness. Because when I'm preoccupied with what's wrong with others, the implication is I'm very aware of what's right with me. Oh, they're this, they're that, they're that. Implication, I'm this, that, 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 that. And as we know, pride is an absolute stench in the nostrils of God. So think about this. How can I develop my ability to encourage someone else with words? Step one, Lord, cause me to be a humble person so that I can be even aware of the most minute movements of your grace in the lives of other people. I need to see that. Help me to see that. And then as we grow in seeing that, at that point, we can start sharing that with them verbally. And then it's not empty flattery. It's not just sort of trying to put on a happy face. And really, when we look at our words, we discover the condition of our own hearts. Our words report on the conditions of our own souls. Sinclair Ferguson put it this way: our use of the tongue is a sure evidence of the condition of our heart. It is the hinge on which the door into our souls swings open in order to reveal our spirit. In effect, our words are like so many media people rushing to file their reports on the condition of our soul. And so we see Proverbs 4:23 saying, "Watch over your heart with all diligence, for from it flow the springs of life." What do we see in the words of the apostle of love in 3 John? Exactly what we would expect: love. And the encouragement of this man. May we grow to become more like him in that way. But not only is genuine love affirming, genuine love is also active. It's active. We see that in the second portion of verse 5, going on through verse 8. But he talks about, "In whatever you accomplish for the brethren, and especially when they are strangers, and they bear witness to your love before the church, and you will do well to send them on their way in a manner worthy of God, for they went out for the sake of the name, accepting nothing from the Gentiles. Therefore we ought to support such men, that we may be fellow workers with the truth." The phrase there, for whatever you accomplish, it really implies that there's going to be some toil, some effort involved in this living out of love. These were brethren here that had come, fellow believers in Christ. And these recipients of Gaius' hospitality were those that received hospitality from him in the midst of their journeys. Undoubtedly, he received them at their house, and he entertained them at his own expense. And this service was done, again, faithfully. It was done out of his faith because of his trust in the living God. So his practical ministry to these gospel laborers was true to his profession. So, and again, we see love is consistent here. His love evidenced is consistent with the truth that he believes. Hospitality is something today that is also very much appreciated. It's one of those things, I think, where you see throughout the history of the world, there's always been, culturally, one thing that man always has: a home. That never changes. All sorts of other things change. Everything's in flux. But somehow, some way, human beings live in places, and God provides them a home. In the early church, you see also house churches developed, right? Why? Because they were the places people could gather and be together. All of us as Christians are called to this idea of hospitality. And the idea of that even goes far back into the Old Testament era. The Old Testament passages that would talk about this would be Exodus 23:9, when it says, "And you shall not oppress a stranger, since you yourselves know the feelings of a stranger. For you were strangers in the land of Egypt." And Leviticus 19:10, "Nor shall you glean your vineyard, nor shall you gather the fallen fruit of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the needy and for the stranger, for I am the Lord your God." And so later in the New Testament, the same principle is clarified. And the New Testament term for hospitality really means stranger loving. Someone who's able to love strangers. Romans 12:10 talks about the New Testament believer's command to be someone like this. It says this: be devoted to one another in brotherly love. Give preference to the one another in honor, not lagging behind in diligence, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord, rejoicing in hope, persevering in tribulation, devoted to prayer, contributing to the needs of the saints, and practicing hospitality. There it is. 1 Peter 4:9 says, be hospitable to one another without complaint. Others are to be particularly hospitable. Widows, it says in 1 Timothy 5:10, are to be have a good reputation for good works. And it goes on to say, if she has brought up children, if she has shown hospitality to strangers, there it is. If she's washed the saints' feet, if she has assisted those in distress, if she has devoted herself to every good work. The other people who are specifically commanded to be hospitable are elders, those who lead in the church. 1 Timothy 3:2, an overseer then must be above reproach, the husband of one wife, temperate, prudent, respectable, hospitable, able to teach. Titus 1:7 would say the same thing. The overseer must be above reproach as God's steward, not self-willed, not quick-tempered, not addicted to wine, not pugnacious, not fond of sordid gain, but hospitable, loving what is good, sensible, just, devout, self-controlled. So we see from these passages that hospitality is really a beautiful form of generosity. It's something that specifically has to do with being generous with the home that God's given for the care and support of believers, especially the generosity of that home when it comes to the furtherance of the gospel. Now, we didn't talk about 2 John very much last week, but we need to understand something here. There were some qualifications or limits placed upon how much hospitality was to be given to these traveling missionaries. Because the fact is, it may surprise you, people took advantage of it. They'd say, yeah, I'm a traveling missionary, I'm coming through here, and all of a sudden, they're there for one day, they're there for 2 days, they're going on 3 days, going on 4 days. That old proverbial saying, you know, with having a house guest, right, is how long does fish stay good in the fridge? And it's about 3 days. That's about all you got. 3 days, fish goes bad, and guess what? So for some reason, you stay past that time period, things are going to go a bit foul in the relationship. Well, because of the problem of the abuses, 2 John addresses that more pointedly, but there was also another document. It was called the Didache, or the teaching. And really, it was the teaching of the 12 apostles on this issue of what to do with these traveling missionaries. And what happened was the document that was penned was circulated through the early church for the purpose of helping people understand what they are to do with this issue of hospitality. And I'll read you just a brief portion of the Didache. It says this. Again, these are the apostles. They got together and put together this document, the teaching. It says this: let every apostle who comes to you be received as the Lord, but he shall not remain more than 1 day or 2 days if there is need. But if he remains 3 days, he's a false prophet. Okay. Hey, it's third day. Guess what? You're a false prophet. Get out of here. Right? That was very, very straightforward. And when the apostle goes away, let him take nothing but bread until he lodges. If he asks for money, he's a false prophet. Okay. Pretty clear. And that's how they were able to discern what to do in this area of hospitality. But it's important to note here that with Gaius's love toward these genuine missionaries, it wasn't just a mere sentiment. It wasn't something he only talked about with them. Instead, it was an action. And really, always and everywhere, people that live out their convictions with a generous heart, that is something that God loves, something that he smiles upon. And I just have to say right now, I am so grateful for what God has done here at Hope Bible Church. I am amazed, really, at the generosity of his people here. I was thinking, even though I was getting ready for this, I was thinking of the faces I would see, and I'm going, oh Lord, don't let me break down and start crying. But I really do believe that there is a lot of saints here who really do live out what they believe because of their kindness toward one another and generosity. I think some of the people in this congregation are the best at hospitality I've ever known. And sharing what God's given them and their home for the purpose of furthering the gospel and taking care of others. There are oftentimes, as a pastor here, that I get to see things that probably most of you don't. We kind of get a different perspective because we're sometimes used in the process of coordinating need for other people. But there is so often that one person shares and gives to another, and it's never known by anybody else at all. It happens all the time. So the combination of firm convictions and generosity, the Lord himself is so pleased when we are involved in ministry like that. And that's a joy. It's a joy to even be a part of a group of believers in that way. And that's what Gaius was like. And so he goes on to say, "And you will do well to send them on their way in a manner worthy of God." In a manner worthy of God. Really, the idea here is that it's as if they were God himself, you're sending them off. And not only that, but God himself is pleased with the way you've cared for them. He's pleased in that way. He then goes on to explain the reason for these acts of faith, why they're so important. And we see that in verse 7. It says, "For they went out for the sake of the name." This is giving the motives of those who went out. They went out for a reason. They went out for the sake of the name. The name, without a doubt, is the name Jesus Christ. There is no other name under heaven by which we must be saved. And such an absolute name really denotes Christ as the one who is supreme over all. The one who sends forth these missionaries for the purpose of furthering his kingdom. They sought to evangelize these people, and what they did, it goes on to say in verse 7 that they accepted nothing from them. They didn't want any misunderstanding to grow in the hearts of those they were trying to reach. They, if anything, wanted to make sure that they were a huge contrast with other traveling evangelists of the day. One commentator cited an inscription of a man who called himself the slave of his Syrian goddess. And he boasted that he never returned from his begging journeys with any less than 70 bags of money for his goddess. Now, in stark contrast with that, these missionaries wanted to keep themselves completely free from profiting in any way from the people they were trying to share the gospel with. And so what happened is the missionary obligation then fell to believers. Those already in the family. And this duty of support wasn't like a church tax. It's not like what the Mormon church does today, where you go over and you show up at, you know, "Brother Henry, yes, well, we did get that copy of your W-2. And we did note that you've only given this much per year, but if we take that decimal point, move it over one on your total gross for the year, you owe us this much. So do you want to cut us a check now, or do we have to deal with this further?" Whoa. That's not what this is. This is free will giving. Giving because God has placed it on the heart of the person to do that. Giving because God's been so generous with them. And so it's not a church tax, but it's an inner sense of moral obligation accepted as a standing duty. Why? Because these people went out for the sake of the name. And because of that, there's a desire to share in what God's given. And there's a spiritual goal for this participation. He says that we may be fellow workers with the truth. So these internal realities of the Christian faith, they demonstrate themselves in this external conduct. And in supporting these missionaries, fellow believers demonstrate that they themselves are also fellow workers with the truth. When you and I participate in the missionary endeavor, either through giving or through going on short-term trips or whatever it ends up being, either way, we are fellow workers with the truth. You know, the team is about to head out. The ambassadors, they're heading for Moldova. That's exciting. They're ambassadors for the truth. Do you know that as we support them in prayer and as we support them in other ways, We're fellow workers in that endeavor. We have our missionaries. We pray for them every Sunday when we take the offering. Why? Because it is at that moment that we are declaring to one another, reminding ourselves, and even coming before God with the reality that we are fellow workers with the truth. We get to participate in that as we share and support those efforts. And there's also an important principle here of giving. The fact is there are so many different causes and so many different things that believers could give to. But the fact is what we ought to be doing, as good as some of those things can be, is to support the efforts of the truth making an impact in the world. Gospel-centered efforts. Because those are the things that the world is just not going to support. And that's what we're called to support. About 10 days after the attack on Pearl Harbor, there was a group of citizens in North Platte, Nebraska, and they heard a rumor that there were soldiers from their town that were a part of the Nebraska National Guard Company D. And that these guys are going to be coming through on a troop train on their way to the West Coast. So what they did is 500 people showed up at the train depot with food, cigarettes, and letters for the boys. They wanted to show love and support. So when the train showed up, it wasn't the Nebraska National Guard Company D on board. It was the soldiers from the Kansas National Guard Company D. So after a few awkward moments, a woman handed a young man she'd never seen gifts that were intended for her own son. Everyone else followed that lead. There were hugs, prayers, and love shared all around. It was a spontaneous act of genuine devotion that touched both the soldiers and the people who came to the depot that day. That alone would have been a beautiful illustration of sacrifice for one another. But really, the story goes on. A few days later, a 26-year-old woman named Ray Wilson wrote a letter to the editor of the local paper recounting the profound experience that she had had that night. She then suggested to the town that they organize a canteen so they could do something similar for every troop train that came through. She offered to lead the effort as a volunteer, and for the next 4.5 years, the people of North Platte and the surrounding communities met every troop train that came through their town. Every day, they prepared sandwiches, cookies, cold drinks, and hot coffee. They held baskets of magazines and books to give away to the soldiers. They even had birthday cakes made for some of them if they had a special day. And they did all of this, some days, for as many as 8,000 soldiers and sailors. The statistics are just staggering, because by the time the last train arrived on April 1st, 1946, 6 million soldiers had been blessed by the North Platte canteen. Wow. 45,000 volunteers had served faithfully until the war was over, and most of the troops had been transported back home. Most of the soldiers had really only 10 minutes to be there. They would grab some food. They'd hear the appreciation of some, maybe get a present. They'd sprint back to the train and left quickly. But in those 10 minutes, they got much more than a meal. They received a dose of unconditional love that they remembered later, during the heat of the battle, as well as decades after the war was even over. Bob Green, whose book entitled Once Upon a Town, made the North Platte canteen story known to the entire world. And he wrote that as he interviewed many of those who had been through the canteen firsthand, some surviving soldiers, there was one universal reaction from all the men, who by that time were in their late 70s and 80s. They cried. Each one wept. It's a beautiful picture of care, of generosity, of sharing. And that was done for an earthly war. We're in a battle where eternal outcomes are at stake. What are you and I doing to care for our brothers and sisters in the midst of this conflict? Are we merely assenting in our faith, or are we active in love? Especially in this area of hospitality. Do you love to open up your home for the service of brothers and sisters, especially in furthering the gospel? Are you generous in other ways with your time and resources for the sake of the name? As we long to become people of genuine love, we need to ask God to forgive us for the times when we're just not, for the tendencies of our hearts to just sort of get introverted and focus on ourselves. So let's confess that to Him now. We're now going to embark upon a time of communion. And the fact is as much as we want to be a people of affection, oftentimes we're not. We want to be people of truth, and oftentimes we aren't. People of prayer, who pray for one another, and we fail in that endeavor. People who are affirming in our words, encouraging to one another, and so often we're not. And we want to be people who are active in our love. Not just passive spectators. So as the men distribute the bread and as we consider this, think on your own life and confess to God your lack of love. And confess to Him your need for Jesus again.